protect your boats and recreational vehicles with FBP RV and Marine antifreeze. It has burst-proof protection down to negative 50 degrees, keeping you protected against freezing temperatures. Keep your winter worry-free with FBP ready-to-use RV and Marine antifreeze now at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com and shop our great selection of automotive products. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, a contributor to the Bulwark and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. And I'm joined in all things strategery by my colleague, Elliot Cohen, who is professor of strategy emeritus at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, I want you to know that strategery is backed by popular demand because a number of our intrepid listeners and viewers noticed that I didn't say strategery last week, but that they love the sort of, you know, the reference. So I'm bringing it back.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, so Eric, I want to say everything is so much clearer to me now. And that's not because I have political enlightenment. It's because I had cataract surgery on both eyes. And I know it makes you squeamish. So I'm not going to talk about how they stick needles into your eyes and pull out, because I know that bothers you, so I'm not going to talk about it.
Thank you.
I have also been hearing from our devoted listeners, people that may not realize we have a large and devoted, or at least a devoted listening audience in Australia.
Ah.
And I've been bombarded. Well, actually, I've gotten only a couple, but I've gotten a number of messages from our Australian friends who seem to be particularly upset over the fact that this is transitioning into jackassery, that these islands which have only been inhabited by penguins are now subject to tariffs. And the Australians were complaining a lot about this. Now, you know, I've responded that it's a little bit rich for a country that has some of the most lethal wildlife on the planet to all of a sudden get all squishy about a bunch of penguins who haven't really done a whole lot for the United States recently, if you think about it. But there's that. So actually, that's one piece of on the jackassery watch segment of our show. The other, which is somewhat more serious, although I don't take it that seriously, is Donald Trump is going to have a military parade, apparently, in Washington, D.C. on his birthday, which I think will make him look more ridiculous than anything else. But I think you may feel that this is, you know, Sulla getting ready to take over Rome.
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, it's sort of totally buffoonish, you know, and so, and absolutely deserving of ridicule, right? On the other hand, I recall, you know, that our mutual friend, Paul Selva, who was then the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and who grew up in authoritarian Portugal, told the president when the president was musing in his first term about a parade that Paul had grown up in a country where, you know, leaders insisted on military parades and that we don't really do that, you know, in the United States of America. And there's a lot, you know, I think a lot to that. So it's certainly buffoonery of the first order. You know, it's, you know, reflects Trump's, I think, insecurity and the fact that, you know, when Macron put on, you know, the Bastille Day parade for Trump, he you know, developed parade envy. Make of that what you will, you know, about what other inadequacies he's feeling. But
it's also he has, as does Hegseth, in a somewhat different way, in a dark, even darker way, a kind of a truly childish conception of what the American military is. You know, and so he's like an 11-year-old kid that wants to dress up in uniforms and march around and stuff like that. And, you know, he doesn't understand that that's not our way. That actually makes military people very uncomfortable. There are some precedents. You know, I, as we were talking about before the show, I was actually quite uncomfortable when after the first Gulf War, there was this big military display on the downtown. And, you know, that, including tanks and stuff like that. And that didn't really sit all that well with me either. I think this will, the fact that particularly that it's on his birthday, it will make him look more ridiculous.
Yeah, and the birthday thing.
And there's a good chance that he will be doing this in the middle of a severe recession, which will make it less amusing. But I know I take the point. It's whatever it is. It's still jackassery.
Yeah. And one could add to it, but it's such so much more sinister and therefore, you know, something we need to talk about more seriously. The appearance of Laura Loomer, you know, in the Oval Office, followed by the cashiering, first of all, of a number of senior directors at the National Security Council, other staff. I don't think we know exactly the number that have been cashiered at the National Security Council. I mean, they supposedly it was three, then it was six. I've heard other numbers, 10 and 13.
Yeah, I heard 13.
There's been, you know, at least one directorate that's been completely dissolved and a number of people who've been sent back, detailees who've been sent back to their home agencies. So I don't think we know the full extent of this. Other than that, you know, what lessons one can draw from this. First of all, the idea that the president of the United States takes his counsel from this woman who is a complete crazy person who has, you know, speculated about 9/11 being an inside job, who's clearly an Islamophobe, you know, a nativist, you know, she's just crazy. Even the Trump campaign thought she was crazy and tried to keep her from traveling with him, for instance, on the anniversary of 9/11 in the campaign. But for her to be dispensing it, you know, advice that is then, you know, being actually executed on personnel side is very, very troubling. It's also a little bit troubling, I would think, when you think about, you know, what this says about Mike Waltz's standing in the administration. Of course, she was advocating for Waltz to be fired because of Signalgate. But also, she had been waging a absolutely racist campaign against Alex Wong, Mike Waltz's deputy, a despicable campaign. To his credit, Tom Cotton actually stood up for Alex, Alex had worked for Tom, so it was fitting that he would stand up for him. You know, I think both of them are still sort of, you know, got one foot on a banana peel, as it were. The other thing that's striking is that a number of the people who were let go were people who had worked for Marco Rubio, which raises questions about Rubio's standing in the administration as well. And I don't want to say that, you know, Waltz and Rubio are the adults in the room, because they certainly haven't behaved that way during the course of the first, 2 months plus of this administration. But let's put it this way. They're some of the less crazy, more normal voices, you know, in the national security councils of this administration. So none of it, I think, can be read, you know, as a good thing.
No, it's a terrible thing. I think there are a couple of other angles. One is, so apparently what she does is, you know, she scours the internet and finds stuff about people. And, you know, it brings home that in this day and age, you know, and I actually, in a different context, I've been thinking about this, you know, with AI and even things like Google News, you can just scarf up an enormous amount of information. You begin looking up everybody who's working, and why don't you go find their full employment history and so on. And many of them were, you know, had normal kinds of jobs in the last normal Republican administration, or may have said something, you know, which set her off. So that's all part of the publicly available record. And so she can do that. Second thing that struck me is Waltz was in the room, apparently, as she was sort of And there is something a little bit Stalin-esque about this. And I think Trump enjoyed this. I mean, he was clearly ticked off at Waltz about the Goldberg incident, because I think he assumed that Waltz was talking to Goldberg. Now, apparently their internal survey said, well, actually what happened was Goldberg had asked about a story and, you know, who knows?
He got sucked into Mike Waltz's phone. That's their story, and they're sticking to it.
But you know, it's a way of, I think Trump actually likes to have people around him who've been broken,
yeah,
in a way, and who are vulnerable. So it's not just that, I think, as a measure of their standing, I think this is a deliberate technique to intimidate, to make them worried, to make them anxious, to make them compliant. And I'm sure the same thing is true with Rubio as well. And you know, you just, the last thing I'll say on this, you just wonder with people like Waltz and Rubio, who both, you know, I had glancing contact with both. You had a bit more than glancing contact. I wonder if they ever wake up in the middle of the night, was, you know, and ask themselves, was it worth sacrificing my integrity,
yeah,
to be treated this way by this man? I mean, you and I would say no, but maybe other people say yes.
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I don't, you're fond of quoting, you know, Thomas More in Man for All Seasons, talking to Richard Rich about, you know, a man giving up his soul for whales. Is it really worth being National Security Advisor or Secretary of State under these circumstances? I can't imagine. There are other parts to this that I would, you know, add, which is, in addition to the NSC bloodletting, there also was the firing of the Cybercom and NSA director and deputy, General Hawk, who was relieved of command. I don't know well, but I know a little bit, and an extremely impressive officer.
That's what everybody says. Also, our military representative to NATO was just fired, who probably guilty of the sin of being female.
All of this just is extremely, you know, when you think about, I don't know whether it was Loomer, you know, or another visitor to Washington this week, which we can get into, who pushed for General Hawk to be fired. Of course, he just had a meeting not long ago with Elon Musk, so who knows whether Musk had a role in this? I have no idea. But the fact that the Cybercom NSA director fired the director of CISA, which is, you know, the agency that provides for internet security, particularly of our elections, all of this is just leaving us vulnerable to, you know, our adversaries in a way that is unconscionable, in my view.
Yeah, I agree. But none of this is the really big stuff.
Yeah, really, I know. Of course, these stories have all been obliterated by, you know, by.
That's the amazing thing. The big stuff, obviously, is this, these wild tariffs, you know, based on a formula which apparently they sort of botched, which, you know, rather simple formula, but which is, you know, led the stock market into a bear market. So like about 20% fall is having all kinds of repercussions. To start off the discussion on that, let me just open with two things. One is, I've always thought that Trump is actually presiding over a coalition. I mean, he actually, you know, this is one of the few things that he's sincere about. He has a vision of the United States, which really is a 1950s, early 50s vision. Lots of smokestacks, you know, large labor force. And he thinks that the way, and in some ways, it's a 20s and 30s vision, you know, protected by tariffs, not really interested in the outside world, very aggressive within the hemisphere. So, you know, there's a certain coherence to the Canada, Greenland, Panama Canal thing. So he's this combination of the early 50s, 20s, and 30s. But it's a big coalition. And some of these people are like Elon Musk, these sort of techno-visionary fantasist. It's interesting that Musk denounced Peter Navarro and said, well, it would be great if we had zero tariffs between the United States and Europe, which is not Navarro's position. You know, you have some people who are for whom I think this is a deep culture war kind of thing, where Trump is the vehicle to, you know, somehow, you know, really restore a kind of white dominated, male dominated America. There's a section of the evangelical movement for whom this is all religious. So I think it's actually a rather complicated coalition that he's put together. And I have to say, I wonder if this might be the thing that breaks it, or at least that, you know, puts such fissures in it that you can't get over it. Then the last thing, which maybe is a separate topic we can talk about later, I think this is the one that really conclusively means that we can't go back again to where we were before. Now, the question is where we do go. But I think that's, for me, that's the big thing. But I just put a lot on the plate. What do you have to say?
Well, I mean, the best advice to give anybody is don't look at your 401k or your funds, you know, because
too late.
Yeah, because it's obviously not going to be a pleasant, you know, experience, at least for now. Look, I think this is definitely going to hurt a lot of people in his own, you know, coalition, his own states and red states. But this is not the only thing he's done that's going to do that. The anti-vax stuff and the stuff that he did during the pandemic, we know from studies led to excess deaths in red states compared to blue states. So at some level, they're literally killing their own voters. When you add to that the, you know, the disproportionate effect that all these DOGE government cuts are going to have, both on veterans who are being hit disproportionately and who disproportionately live in red states, and the social services that red states, because by and large they're more rural and poorer, and therefore rely more on federal assistance for a variety of things, you know, whether it's libraries and museums, whether it's support to agriculture,
Medicaid,
all of this stuff is going to hurt his people. Now, the thing that, you know, I don't quite know how to parse is what Sarah Longwell has found on some of her focus groups and what, you know, you see anecdotally in interviews that are done with Trump voters. I trust him, you know, might be hurting me now, but it's going to be good for me in the long run. And how long that lasts, I just don't know. I think you're already seeing signs that among independent voters, this is costing him a lot. And particularly those who voted in 2024 for him because they thought he would be bringing back the prosperity they remember from the first term. This, I think, by, as you say, by his birthday, by June 15th, is going to look a lot different. I also think at some point, the fact that so much of this, the tariffs, among other things, are, you know, going to lead to all sorts of, you know, fiddling of exceptions for, you know, cronies and the sort of corruption that it will, encourage beyond all the other corruption that's going on, I think may break through at some point to some of these folks. And I think that, you know, is going to be a huge, huge problem. But it's also, as our colleague Jonathan Last has pointed out today, I mean, it's going to be a problem for us too, because the more his public support goes down, the more he's politically wounded, you know, the more dangerous a situation potentially the Republic is in.
Yeah, I think that's true. Actually, you know, there's one other effect which I think is interesting. I'm being a bit more on the hopeful side. I mean, how does he have the power to do this? Answer: Congress gave presidents the power, specifically in 1977, under the sainted Jimmy Carter. And, you know, finally, you see in the House, and even much more so in the Senate, you have, I think, seven Republicans have signed up for a bill that's going to dial back those authorities to where they belong, which is Congress. Congresses are the ones who are supposed to, you know, I think, set set tariffs. I mean, yeah. Within allowing some discretion to the president for exactly how they're implemented. But, you know, the executive's job is to execute. It's not to legislate. And I wonder if you're beginning with something like this, you're wondering if you're beginning to see some of the Republicans finally getting back some willingness to assert institutional prerogatives. You know, I just saw a clip of Rand Paul, who I don't normally agree with, giving a real stem winder on his opposition to one man rule. And, you know, being pretty ferocious, I think, in his denunciation of Trump. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think this is these people recovering a conscience or a spine. What I think it is, and I think this is the ultimate tipping point, when they are more afraid of their own voters than they are of Trump. Now, they are very afraid of Trump, so they're going to have to get really afraid
right.
of their own voters before they actually, you know, are willing to stand up to him.
So, again, a lot to unpack here. You know, I too have noted these sort of little green shoots poking up of, you know, people being willing to say that we ought to take some of this power back in the hands of the Congress. And, that is an encouraging sign. However, Trump has already indicated he would veto any such effort, which means they're cooked because they're not ever going to be able to overcome a veto. Given the numbers in the House and Senate, at least House and Senate as currently configured. The other thing is, I'm of two minds, having been a creature for most of my, you know, professional life of the executive branch. I'm a little bit of two minds on the whole tariff thing and the authority, you know, whether it resides in the Congress or with the president. The problem is, it's a classic collective action problem. You know, when trade policy resides in the Congress, it's almost impossible to get anything negotiated because the benefits of trade are broad and general, and the costs are very specific. And the result is that you get people pushing for their particular issue to be protected. And we know that people, you know, by and large, be more motivated than that, than they are as consumers to say, oh, but in overall, I'll benefit because I'll have cheaper prices for everything. So without some kind of, trade authority for the president, you know, TPA or whatever, it's very difficult to ever negotiate a trade agreement. Now, nobody anticipated. I mean, the problem has been people gave the president this authority so that he would lower tariffs and make it easier to get to free trade. Nobody anticipated when they did this that they were going to have a president use a cockamamie formula like the one they came up with and also mess that up and not even get the math right. Yeah. And as a result,
not math. Arithmetic.
And as a result, you know, quadruple the level of tariffs that even their own formula suggested they ought to impose.
Yeah, I guess the reason why I disagree with you is, or to some extent, I mean, as is usual, I'm thinking about it in a somewhat broader context in that I do think this is a constitutional crisis, but not in the sense that a lot of people have construed it as it's the end of the republic and we're going to become, you know, a dictatorship or something like that. But I think it does tell us that in a fundamental way, the system has been bent out of shape. There has been a very long process of presidents either being given or seizing power, which others were not willing to exercise. And it's time to change that. I mean, I mean, this is an area where I'm, you know, I feel I don't have nearly enough expertise to know exactly what ought to be done. But I do think that this is a time for some creative thinking about a package of measures when either you have an overwhelming kind of reform-oriented majority in the House and the Senate, or you have, you know, a Democratic president who understands the need to do that, which is going to reestablish some of the balance between the legislative branch and the executive branch. And, you know, a lot of people pointed out Congress did this. It's, I mean, there are ways in which presidents have taken power going back to, you know, the Louisiana Purchase and the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War. But an awful lot of it is squarely on the shoulders of Congress, I think.
It's true, but I think that a lot of it is because Congress has kind of willingly given up a lot of its own prerogatives, in part because it can't function. It is, you know, there's been a long kind of secular progression of the Congress's inability to actually carry out basic functions like, you know, passing budgets, you know, every year, you know, appropriating, you know, doing appropriations for each department of the government under normal order.
But then I think that isn't that part of, you know, the program of reform we're going to need is figure out why exactly is that and what can be done to fix it. I mean, that's why I mean, in that respect, I do take the constitutional crisis argument seriously. It's just I think people are, you know, in a way narrowing it into, you know, this particular guy is going to try to establish himself as a dictator. Whereas I think that the problem is that our some of our fundamental institutions are, you know, badly damaged, not fit for purpose, and it's time to rethink them.
By the way, both can be true.
I will give you that. You know, there's another way, actually, which I want. Let me push this argument a little bit further. So, like you, apart from the emails and messages from our Australian friends complaining about the penguins, I've been hearing actually, you know, from some of them, but from a lot of Europeans and others. You know, they know where I stand, obviously, but it really does make me feel that this really is part of the break with our continuity over the last 80 years, and it is a break. And I think it's hard in a way for people like us who kind of grew up during the Cold War and were part of a cast of people who were kind of brought up to steer executive branch institutions, not Congress, through this, to accept the fact that this is really going to be different. Now, I think I had a very interesting exchange with a Polish, very thoughtful Polish friend of mine who, you know, and asked what his feeling is. He said, you know, and he said, we can't change any of it. He said, that means that there's need to rethink a whole bunch of institutions, some of which were actually kind of rotten or deeply problematic anyway. And what this has done is this is going to be destruction. And the challenge is to see if we can make any of it creative destruction. And I tend to agree with that. I mean, that's why I've tended to push back on friends of mine who are putting all of their emotional energies into hating Trump and, you know, fearing what he's going to do and all that, as opposed to saying, okay, this is where we are, you know, where will we be able to go in the future?
Yeah. I mean, so a couple of things. One, you know, I accept everything you've said. I mean, I do think a lot of us have, you know, a lot of nostalgia for the past 80 years because overall
it was pretty good.
It left us in a pretty good situation, and to watch it just wantonly be destroyed is, I think, tough for a lot of people to take, certainly for me. It's undoubtedly true. I mean, the FT had a terrific article about this, about the stickiness of tariffs. So, you know, once you get tariffs in, it's very hard to get them off. And it's also, there's, you know, clearly gonna be a ratchet effect, which is, you know, prices are going to go up because, you know, people are going to, you know, pass along the cost of these tariffs to consumers. I mean, do you have any confidence that once the tariffs come off, prices are going to start coming down again? I mean, you know, they're going to be stuck up there, but also it's tougher to take tariffs off than it is to put them on. And You know, you saw that actually in the transition from the first Trump term to Biden, right? Not that many of the Trump tariffs from the first term came off during Biden, because the Biden folks saw there was some utility in actually using them against the Chinese. And but some of the ones on Europe stayed on too. I mean, you know, it wasn't just China. So, you know, I think you're right. I think, you know, getting back to the status quo ante is not not likely to be, you know, easily done. And the terms of the transatlantic relationship, you know, are going to clearly shift. Now, I still think that it's important to have a transatlantic relationship, because I think Europe can only defend itself with great difficulty. There are a few things that can't be replaced. We've talked about before, like our nuclear deterrent. So I think the terms of this have to be, you know, carefully, you know, thought about, you know, and I think some of the forms need to be preserved as best we can until we get to a post-Trump period. And then they're going to have to be adjusted, because the balance is going to have shifted quite a bit. Because, you know, the Europeans are going to have done a bunch of stuff. I hope they do a bunch of stuff to make themselves better able to defend themselves at least as much as possible. But there's going to have to be some kind of re-equilibration of all of this, you know, once it's all over.
Well, and probably not just in Europe. I mean, I think I think any ally of the United States at this point, even though they will heave a sigh of relief if, you know, the next president is, you pick, Josh Shapiro or, you know, some Jared Polis, I don't know, somebody, but a reasonable Democrat who brings in reasonable people who say reasonable things. I think at the fundamental level, trust in the United States has been broken, and frankly, it should be broken. I mean, having gone through this, I mean, maybe this is a once in a century kind of event. And in that case, you can rebuild some real confidence. But I am not so sure, in part because I think, you know, the formula I've been using when I talk to Europeans in particular is to say that Trump is a cause, he's a catalyst, and he's a symptom. And it's the latter two parts that are the troubling parts, that he has catalyzed certain things that were already there. And he is a symptom of even deeper kind of social problems that actually many societies now face. And, you know, those things are not going to go away because when Trump retires or, you know, is committed to an old age home or something, I mean, they will still be there. So we are really... I really believe we're in a different era. And I, you know, it's interesting. You and I've been, we had that wonderful conversation about Robert Murphy. And by the way, I heard from a lot of people, they would like us to do more of that. Although they want to talk more about the relevance for today.
Yeah.
And I've been reading more and more about World War One. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the way in which you went from one world into another. I mean, the world of 1914 and the world of, say, 1919, 5 years later, utterly different. I mean, those are,
right.
And indeed, from 1914 to 1915 or 1916, you're already in a very, very different world than you were before. And I think we're in that kind of moment.
Well, the same, I mean, I would argue the same is true of World War II, right? 1940 and 1945 are extremely different moments, not least because of the advent of nuclear weapons, but not just. I mean, it also is a radical shift in, you know, how America views its own role in the world, or at least the broad majority of the, you know, dare I use the word elite, who the governing elite, clearly, you know, had a different view of America's role in the world after the war than they did before the war. So, I mean, I think that's right. Well, you know, look, we'll get to talk more about, you know, the sort of economic system in a few weeks when we have Eddie Fishman on to talk about his book, because he does a great job talking about how the system that is being destroyed, it, you know, created so many advantages for us and the ability to use sanctions as a tool rather than, you know, rather than military action. So it's going to be interesting, you know, to talk with him as we, you know, ponder the destruction of the system that he was so lovingly describing in the book. But we've got some other news. I mean, today we had the meeting between President Trump and the Los Angeles Dodgers. No, not that's not what I meant. We had the meeting between Trump and Bibi Netanyahu, who the president summoned to Washington. A lot of reporting from Israeli sources, including those on the plane with Bibi, you know, making his way to Washington, that they had no idea why they were being summoned. A lot of speculation, maybe it was going to be a tariff deal of some kind, because Israel had actually taken off all its tariffs on the United States before the tariffs were announced on Wednesday. Got hit with a 17% tariff anyway. Turns out that President wanted to let Bibi know that the United States and Iran will be starting direct negotiations on Saturday at what the president described at a very high level to resolve the question of the Iranian nuclear weapons program. So what do you make of that?
Well, there's no question that, you know, if you put a good American real estate lawyer like Steve Witkoff up against somebody who is comes from a tradition of centuries upon centuries in the bazaar, undoubtedly the real estate lawyer from New York will succeed and just, you know, pull the wool over their eyes and not.
You mean dealing with the country that actually invented chess?
The country that invented chess, and that is, you know, sort of, it's a cliche of Middle East studies, but, you know, they're rug weavers. You know, they one knot at a time and over a long period of time, which is why how you get these beautiful, beautiful rugs. No, I think, so let me sort of step back a bit. I think one of the things that motivates Trump is making deals. In this respect, as many others, he doesn't escape his background. There's a big difference between making deals and actually achieving something. I mean, anybody who's dealt with a real estate agent knows their interest is in closing the deal. Whether you get the best price or not the best price, that's actually less of an issue. Their motivation is close the deal. And I think that's very much what Trump wants. He has in his self-conception, he's a master deal maker. So he will cut deals with anybody, including the Chinese, certainly including Putin, certainly including the Iranians, so that, you know, he can do all this. Point one. Point two, I mean, these guys, there's a reason why they have the jackassery segment. They are not competent. They are not serious. In many respects, they are not smart. And the upshot of that is that there's a good chance that they'll get taken to the cleaners. And particularly if he throws Steve Witkoff into it, who, you know, was parroting Russian talking points, you know, after his first meetings with them. So I think there's that. You know, I have a very dark view of Bibi Netanyahu. I think, you know, he's smarter than Trump. And he has handled some aspects of the Gaza war well, but he is doing damage to Israeli democracy. Of that, there's very little doubt. And he is this sort of dark, manipulative, would-be authoritarian figure who's clinging to power for the sake of power, which, by the way, is the other side of all this is, you know, with Trump and with Bibi, it's not ideology, it's power, which is in some ways the most dangerous thing of all. So I worry about what kind of deal we'll cut with the Iranians the same way I worry about any deal this guy cuts. There's a separate set of issues. I mean, first, I'd like to hear what you have to say about the Iranians, but I think that the separate set of issues here is what the Israelis are up to. Now, I will add one thing, though, where I guess I will give the administration credit. It does sound to me like they've been pounding away at the Houthis, which Biden was never willing to do. That was onesies and twosies. And I think that may have unnerved the Iranians somewhat. I think that may have been the intention. I saw a report somewhere that the Iranians actually were pulling their people out of Yemen. Will that actually resolve the issue? Actually, I tend to think not, because, you know, unless you have troops on the ground, I tend to be, as somebody who spent a good part of his life studying air power, I just tend to be skeptical. Not saying it couldn't happen, but I'm somewhat skeptical. But in any case, that's my take on Iran. But then maybe we can talk about Israel.
Yeah, and you know, let's do that. So, I largely share your concerns. On the Houthis, let me just say, yes, the administration has been pounding them since the conversation on Signalgate, went forward. Been continuously pounding them, and have spent, you know, I think on the order of $1 billion now, or pretty close to it, in terms of munitions and what have you. It's not clear to me how much of an effect they've had. They must have had some, but they have not been, you know, very forthcoming in terms of, they've claimed that they've eliminated a lot of senior leaders. They haven't identified who they are, so it's a little hard to evaluate the, you know, the claims. It does seem to have had an impact, I will say, on Tehran, however, because we've also seen reports that the PMFs, Popular Mobilization Forces, Iranian-backed Shia militias in Iraq, are talking about disarming and becoming part of the Iraqi National Army, et cetera, which suggests that there's some demonstration effect going on here that may be salutary, which is good. What I worry about here is that the Iranians have been, you know, busy enriching uranium up to 60%. They've got a lot of it. They're getting perilously close to being able to, in very short order, have enough fissile material for several weapons. And David Albright at the Institute for Science and International Security tracks this, you know, pretty closely. We're also running close to the deadline for the Europeans to agree to snap back all the sanctions. That expires in October. And the Iranians just excel at sort of getting one wrapped up in a long, interminable negotiation, which is what they did with the Biden people. And so I do worry that, you know, this is, you know, that we're going to sleepwalk into a situation where any kind of military solution, which is already going to be difficult, you know, I don't want to underestimate that, is going to become almost impossible. And at which point you get another set of issues arising, which is, you know, if Iran actually crosses the nuclear threshold and you don't have a military solution, well, first of all, the Israelis may go with or without us. I don't know. I mean, I do think it's existential for them. So they may, you know, may just go, you know, you get into a whole set of questions of, do we help them? Don't we help them? Et cetera. I would add one other thing to what you said about, you know, the sort of incompetence and the difference between real estate deals and, you know, nuclear weapons negotiations, which is something, a point John Bolton has made repeatedly, including when he was on Shield of the Republic back before the election. Trump really desperately wants a Nobel Peace Prize. He's been, you know, envious of Obama, who got one for no particular reason in his first year as president. I mean, it was richly undeserved. Trump, it just, you know, wants that Peace Prize too. And he may think that this is the way to get it. And I worry also that this was not great. And just one other straw in the wind, I don't know if you saw it, but Tucker Carlson tweeted out right before Bibi's arrival that anybody who advocates military action against Iran is not an ally of the United States. You know, there. Because, you know, it goes on and on about, because the war would become, you know, as if this is like, you know, going to be a complete replay of Iraq, when it's a completely different you know, situation.
So, and I think that in a way speaks to my earlier point that the Trump presides over a coalition. So where Carlson is, you know, the authentic isolationist, nativist, it's probably closest to J.D. Vance. You have others who actually, you know, are much more aggressive. That would include people like Lindsey Graham, for example, who is also.
Or Mike Waltz, who has talked. Or Mike Waltz.
Does Trump have an ideological preference? No, I think he doesn't. It's funny. He's willing to embrace the uncertainty of these massive tariffs. I don't think he's willing to embrace the uncertainty of a real war. I mean, that seems to be, as far as we know, that's the case. You know, one other wrinkle on this. One of the sillier comments you probably remember from when we were in government together was somebody in the intelligence community saying, well, they've never had a clandestine nuclear program that we haven't known about. To which the point was, well, if it was clandestine, then you wouldn't know about it. The more sensible thing that I remember hearing from somebody we both know is they have always had a clandestine program. We periodically find out about it. That's all.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, that's something else, particularly. And I think a particular angle to be concerned about now is given the closeness of their partnership with Russia, you know, that has many dimensions. And I'm sure that one of the dimensions is advice about avoiding or confusing or hiding from Western and specifically American intelligence collection capabilities. And this is one of the ways in which this alignment of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea is really so dangerous, because they, from a military point of view, they each have things that they can give to each other. I mean, it's...
I'm honestly more worried about the diplomatic advice that they might give the Iranians about how to suck up to Donald Trump, because the Russians have been doing that extremely effectively, which I would like to get to in a second. But before we do that, I want to get back to the other question you raised, which is, okay, Israel. Putting aside the Iran issue, how to think about the other ongoing issues that Israel has, and he's got a lot of them. There's the war in Gaza that is ongoing with what looks to be a terrible atrocity, perhaps war crime, that may have been committed by some of the IDF in Gaza. There's, continuing violations of, and, you know, uncertainty about the ceasefire with Lebanon. And there's the potential clash between Turkey and Israel in Syria. Israelis just bombed T4, this air base in Palmyra, near Palmyra in Syria, which the Turks have indicated, pretty publicly that they would like to be able to use as an air base, and have been talking with the Syrian government about this. In a normal world with a normal administration, my preference would be actually that the United States get very diplomatically involved and try and work out some kind of deconfliction between two U.S. partners, you know, both of whom can be pretty difficult to work with, the Israelis and the Turks, to prevent anything untoward from happening and destabilizing Syria. Because I think it's in everybody's interest that we get a stable Syria coming out of this, and that's going to be not... You know, that's not going to be an easy trick to accomplish.
So I'm the larger picture here that concerns me. And look, you know, the two of us are about as sympathetic to Israel as one can be. Is, you know, what is the situation which Israel faces itself? Well, first, they're in the middle of a domestic political crisis, which people are not paying much attention to. But, you know, the firing of the head of the domestic security service, they're trying to fire the attorney general. Next, they're the judges. It's very bad. And because Israel's so small, unlike the United States, there really are questions of what's happening to what could happen to Israeli democracy and how it can be corrupted. That's one thing. But I think the other thing is, you know, after October 7th and the war with Hezbollah, the Israelis at a kind of tactical, technical level, as is always the case, operational level, achieved amazing successes. And I think what you're seeing here is a classic case of overinterpreting that. So what do I mean by that? Well, they're taking some little pieces of Lebanon. Now they're trying to negotiate a deal with Lebanon. They're happy with the Lebanese government, which is willing to kind of block Hezbollah, but they expect Hezbollah to come back. They're being much more aggressive on the West Bank. There's a lot of talk of staying permanently in Gaza, which I think is a big mistake, but I think they may go there. They've reoccupied what was actually, it was the buffer zone, which they withdrew from after the 1973 war and the negotiations that Kissinger ran. But they also are kind of extending a zone of influence to southern Syria, reaching out to the Druze populations, which are vulnerable. And, you know, this is part of the, I mean, the way that the precedents for this go back to the 50s, sort of the peripheral strategy, that what you do is you align with the non-Sunni Middle Eastern ethnic and religious groups that would want to be your friends. And on top of all that, you do hear from some people saying, well, you know, we can really remake the regional order in the Middle East. Now, there are several big problems with that. One big problem is the Saudis are not on side with this. And the Saudis were quite willing at one point to cut a real deal with the Israelis. They are not now. And I can understand why. Their public opinion is not going to tolerate, you know, given what continues to go on in Gaza and on the West Bank, that just not possible. And the Saudi Arabia is not, Brian Katulis, who we've had on, was making the, and who knows the Middle East quite well, was making a perfectly reasonable point. Saudi Arabia is not the United Arab Emirates. Very different country, very different size, very different stakes. So that door is not going to be open. Secondly, I think they really run the risk of exhausting themselves. You know, the army is still a reserve-based army. A lot of these people have done a year, year and a half of reserve duty, and their jobs are going away. You're now beginning to see emigration of high-tech workers from Israel, which has always been a concern. It was not as much a concern before October 7th. Now it is a real and should be a real concern.
Exemptions of Haredi from the draft, which is...
So that's a big issue. There are two other things. One, Martin Van Creveld, the Israeli military historian about whom I sometimes have mixed views, once, however, made a very arresting analogy about although he was in some ways a hardliner, in other ways he was a dove, and he really wanted to sort of get out of the West Bank and Gaza. And somebody asked him why. He said, if you take the finest sword and you put it in a bath of salt water, sooner or later it's going to get corroded. And I thought that was a very powerful metaphor. You're going to get corroded morally. Your readiness will go down. I mean, you'll have discipline problems. This is all kind of classic stuff. And it's right before us, and you can see it. A military that really did pride itself on, its ethical standards, those are increasingly in jeopardy. And finally, the Israelis have always, at the strategic level, been sort of susceptible to what I think of as Mighty Mouse syndrome. And you see it in all kinds of ways, like when they thought they were going to build their own, you know, design and build their own fighter aircraft, the Levy. You know, with they're thinking of themselves as if they're like Germany or France or Great Britain. And they're not. They're just not on that scale. And they never will be on that scale. And the country is small. Population is fundamental. You know, same size as that of Belgium, maybe. And so I'm actually now quite worried about where they might be heading.
Whenever I hear, you know, remake the region, you know, I all my antenna go up. And look, there's no question that the Israelis have had enormous, as you say, operational success, you know, knocking out Hezbollah, essentially destroying Hamas as an organized fighting force, the collapse of the Assad regime. I mean, they're in many ways, you know, the situation is much more propitious for Israel today than it has been. Although, as you rightly point out, I mean, part of this idea of transforming the region is the Saudi-Israeli normalization. And for a lot of reasons, I think that's receded rather than, advanced as a result of all this. So I worry too about overreach. And I also worry that, you know, there Israelis are, you know, with understandably very concerned about Turkey's role in Syria because of their sponsorship and patronage of HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, its predecessor, the al-Nusra Front, which was an al-Qaeda affiliate. You've got a lot of jihadis still kind of running around who are part of al-Sharra's, you know, coalition, whatever you think of his transformation or not, you know, into a more normal politician. But I do worry that, you know, they could end up bringing about the very thing they're worried about by being overly aggressive here, which is one reason why I think some U.S. diplomacy to deconflict all this would be and sort of keep both Turkey and Israel within bounds inside Syria would probably be advantageous to all. I do want to, we're running low on time, but I do want to talk at least briefly about one aspect of Ukraine, which is we had a visit recently by the most important of Putin's negotiators, who was not the foreign minister or his national security advisor, who both of whom were in Riyadh for the talks with Marco Rubio, who is also not the most important, you know, negotiator from the U.S. side, but rather Kirill Dmitriev, who is the head of the sovereign wealth fund in Russia, very close to Putin. His wife is a classmate and very close to Katerina Tikhanova, Putin's daughter. And he was
he's
in town.
He's a Stanford graduate.
Stanford graduate, Harvard Business School, Goldman Sachs. He's perfect for the role. And because Americans all think anybody who speaks English is smart, you know, he's particularly well suited.
And positively inclined.
And positively inclined to the U.S. He's perfect foil for Witkoff, who, as you say, I mean, he's, as far as I could tell, Dmitriev has been the Witkoff whisperer. He, you know, everything, every talking point he uses, you see recycled by Witkoff in his conversation with Tucker Carlson, with his interviews on Fox. He's just a never-ending fount of you know, kind of Russian talking points. So Dmitriev was here, met with Witkoff, no readout of what they discussed other than Dmitriev saying that they discussed the many enormous possibilities for economic cooperation with Russia. People seem to have completely forgotten, you know, how hard it is to do business in Russia and why American companies have been leaving in droves, you know, not just because of the war, but because total lack of rule of law. In a patrimonial system where, you know, property rights inhere in the tsar, not in the, you know, not in the person or the corporation. So we don't know what they talked about. But Dmitriev did, over the weekend, allow himself to tweet out that pictures of all the different demonstration, hands-off demonstrations in Washington and other cities across the country that involved, by counts I've seen, upwards of 1.5 million, maybe 2 million people, and suggested that this was the deep state trying to pull off a color revolution in the United States against Donald Trump. Obviously, this is a message, you know, aimed at the MAGA faithful and at the audience of one in Mar-a-Lago. So I'm just curious what you make of all this.
So what strikes me about it is... you know, it's that old line from the Cold War. You know, when you have an arms control negotiation with the Russians, we send our arms control experts, they send their America experts. And, you know, what you have with Dmitriev is, you know, I think Putin, being a good secret policeman, he's picked the right guy to get to Witkoff, who I'm sure knows how to make Witkoff feel comfortable because he can blither business school speak at him. And of course, Witkoff, who really is a dummy in this way, I think, you know, falls for the view that the negotiator isn't an emissary of, you know, the czar sitting in Moscow, but really the guy with whom you're actually negotiating. You're not actually negotiating with him. You know, you're talking to an emissary of Putin. So, again, it's a way in which we're outclassed. Having said all that, I'll say two things. One of the hardest economic knocks that the Russians have gotten is the price of oil going below $50 because Donald Trump is blowing up the global economic system. I mean, that actually...
Let's just make sure we stipulate, however, that that was not by intent.
No, of course not. But you know, I mean, it shows that even accidentally, it's occasionally possible to do some good. The other thing, though, that I'm really struck by is, and as you know, I've been, you know, arguing with friends of mine who are really convinced that Putin is simply a Russian agent and he's determined to screw...
You mean Ukraine. Trump is.
Trump is, I'm sorry, that he's determined to, you know, do in Ukraine. As far as I can tell, the weapons and the intelligence still flowing. The Russians have wanted it, are trying to get more out of us than we seem to be willing to give. Rubio was making vaguely, you know, weakly threatening noises. And so, you know, I don't know what to make of that, honestly. The other thing Ukraine that's interesting is there's been talk actually of Zelensky trying to have elections. Now, I think that's in part because I think he thinks that he's much more popular now that he's been muscled by Trump. But I guess my point in all this is, even for the Putins of this world, even for the Trumps of this world, turns out lots of other people have agency. No, nothing goes quite the way you plan. Nobody really has control over these sorts of situations. And that's why you actually have to be skillful and knowledgeable when you try to navigate your way through them, because you're not, you know, Trump is not going to get what he wants out of those tariffs. He just isn't. And he may not get it even from relatively small countries.
I guess I have a slightly darker view of it than you do. So yes, you know, intelligence and weapons are still flowing, but the Secretary of Defense has decided to absent himself from the meeting at Ramstein of the Ukraine contact group. So the United States will not be represented at all, as I understand it, at the next meeting. President Trump tariffed Ukraine, but did not tariff Russia at all. I don't see signs. I mean, I know people are saying, well, you know, if Putin pisses him off, he's going to sanction Russia. I don't see any signs of that. I see the opposite. I see signs of some sanctions coming off, including Karina Rotenberg, who is the, you know, wife of, you know, one of Putin's childhood friends, who's, you know, his personal, you know, kind of money bag holder. So I think you know, we may not get any deal here at all. I don't think there's going to be an end to the war. I don't think there's going to be a real full ceasefire. That's probably okay, because the Ukrainians are actually doing a little bit better. The rate of Russian advance is declining. Ukrainians seem to be doing relatively okay in Belgorod, where they've gotten another foothold inside Russia. So I suspect we're just going to have, you know, fighting continue for, you know, the rest of the year. And I don't think we're going to be any closer to an end to the war than when we started.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But I mean, again, doesn't this all get to your framing? I mean, say Hegseth not going to the donors group. In a way, my reaction is, of course not, given the basic disposition of this administration. The key thing is to think about, okay, what kind of structures, you know, can we create in which we're playing a very different role? And I think there, you know, I mean, so if you notice, Rubio is going around saying, no, look, actually, we still believe in the North Atlantic Treaty, as indeed Hegseth has said too. So, okay, so then I think what's the alternative conception that we're going to have to work towards? In a way, it's going to be something that's a little bit more like the original conception of the North Atlantic Treaty before there was an O at the end. In other words, that it is a treaty. I much prefer the old NATO, but we're not going to have the old NATO. So I'm not going to waste time mourning it, or if I do, I'll do it in private. You know, the question is, what are we going to get that may will be different, unsatisfactory, but could conceivably not be disastrous?
Well, on that note, we've gone long and we need to wrap up. I do want to say one final thing, which is, again, you know, our viewing and listening audience have, you know, have spoken, and many of them have complained that, you know, Waldorf and Statler are, you know, grumping about the 1619 project. What do you mean bad history? So I'm not going to get into that now because we're way out of time, but I think we will put in the show notes several essays by very, very prominent historians, Gordon Wood, Sean Wilentz, who was a graduate student at Yale when I was there, and now a very distinguished historian at Princeton, and James Oakes, another distinguished professor of African-American history, all of whom found a lot of flaws and faults with the 1619 project.
Deep flaws. And, you know, do reach out to us. We do read all your emails.
Protect your boats and recreational vehicles with FBP RV and Marine antifreeze. It has burst-proof protection down to negative 50 degrees, keeping you protected against freezing temperatures. Keep your winter worry-free with FBP ready-to-use RV and Marine antifreeze now at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com and shop our great selection of automotive products. Save big money
at Menards. At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.